This podcast is sponsored by Rask Invest, Owen's complete guide to money and investing. Rask Invest members receive Owen's official investment ideas, research on budgets, banking, super and insurance, plus how-to guides to get started. Visit the Rask Finance website to learn more and join today.
Hello and thanks for tuning in to the Australian Investors Podcast, a series exploring the investment philosophies and journeys of some of Australia's leading investors and financial thinkers. I'm Owen Raskovich, founder of the Rask Group. For show notes and other episodes in this series, as well as free educational resources, please visit www.raskfinance.com. Before we go on, it's important to remember the Australian Investors Podcast is provided for educational purposes only and should not be relied upon to make an investment, financial, or taxation decision. The information included in this podcast does not take into account your needs, goals, or objectives, and guests appearing on the show may have a financial interest in some of the products mentioned. Please read all the important disclosure documents and refer to the Rask Group's financial services guide on the Rask Finance website. Luke Cummings is the Chief Investment Officer and co-founder of Harvest Lane Asset Management, a funds management company which focuses on special situations. From a business perspective, Luke has been very successful in a relatively short period of time. As a teenager, he mingled with some of Australia's most highly regarded investors, before rising quickly through the ranks at E-Trade and has since co-founded two businesses. Luke emphasises some important lessons about working hard and taking calculated risks. His investment strategy is relatively unique in Australia, but while it may seem complicated, Luke distills the key tenets very well throughout this episode. If you're new to the world of hedge funds, or you think you may need to brush up on some key terms to get the most from this discussion, please visit the Rask Finance website where we've created a free short course addressing the key ideas discussed in this and future episodes. Please enjoy this conversation with Luke Cummings of Harvest Lane Asset Management. Luke, it's great to have you on the show. Thanks for joining me today.
Owen, thanks for having me.
I think this is going to be a really good chat because you bring some insights to the table that we certainly haven't had on the show before. And not only that, you do it very well. And your strategy and the business that you've started is open to most investors. So I'm really looking forward to getting through and talking about some of the nitty-gritty of what you do. But as with all episodes in the series, I'd like to go back and hear more about you and your journey to finance. So sure. Let's talk about where your passion for finance came from.
Yeah, okay. So look, I guess, you know, a lot of people in my situation, you hear these stories about little businesses they had when they were 8 or 10 years old, or, you know, a grandfather who was interested in stock market investing, or, you know, any number of kind of formative experiences. But, you know, the truth is, in my case, you know, I came from a fairly middle class family. Certainly, I don't think anyone in my family had ever invested in the stock market. It certainly wasn't a topic of a dinner table conversation. And, you know, beyond kind of the ASX share market game, which we, you know, I guess most kids who study finance at school or business studies end up participating in, you know, I did that and had no idea what I was doing, and it would be fair to say. You know, post-school, I was originally going to be studying journalism, and I guess I'd done well in English and, you know, writing at school, and that was kind of the plan, and very much at the last minute decided that that wasn't going to be for me. More or less my earliest role, my first job was at Platinum Asset Management. When, you know, they were probably fairly early stages for them. That would have been around about 1990, late 98, early 99 I was with them. They had 15 people then. I can't remember what funds under management was, but they weren't that far removed from their time at BT. You know, and it was obviously an amazing place to work, and they've done extremely well for themselves. So I think to be in a team of 15 people there, I was by far the youngest and least experienced. But, you know, my desk was outside where they were having the morning meeting every day. So, you know, you couldn't kind of help but hear, you know, what they were talking about and the thought process they would go through around investments and markets. My job was very much an operational role in terms of, you know, making sure that trades were settling and stock was allocated to the correct funds and that type of thing. And I think, you know, it was hard to be in that environment and not be passionate about the market, or at least be more interested in it, because I guess I didn't really understand it at that point. You know, having said that, I think from a monetary perspective, you know, I grew up in a middle-class household. We certainly didn't go without things, but I guess as a kid you're aware of, you know, what people have and don't have, and certainly, you know, I think I was aware of other people who had more than us in terms of whether that's houses or cars or holidays or whatever the case may be. And I think something inside of me liked the idea of having money, I guess for security, or not that I would have called it optionality at the time, but the nice thing I think about, you know, financial security or having money isn't necessarily buying the cars or the houses, although a lot of people probably think when they're starting out that that's what it's about. That's why, you know, you want to accumulate wealth. But I think for me, it's, you know, the security of just kind of knowing you can, within reason, do what you like, that if there's an emergency in the family, that, you know, you have the ability to, you know, to help people through that or help yourself through that. And I think some of the nice things that, you know, you can kind of do for others who are maybe not as fortunate as you are. So, you know, I think that's probably where my interest came from. And I probably read a Rich Dad, Poor Dad book around the time that, you know, I'd started university, and this whole idea of not just the compounding, but, you know, the idea that you can generate money that isn't proportionate to the effort you're putting in, not in terms of not working hard, but, you know, if you're a personal trainer or you're a labourer, or, you know, to some extent, if you're a lawyer or something, you're getting paid by the hour, and the amount of work that you can do, you know, in some way more or less directly correlates to what you're earning. I think the cool thing about investing is that that's not necessarily the case. So I can do the same amount of work every single day, and some days I'm going to make a lot of money and some days I might lose money. And you know, you don't get paid proportionally for your effort. You can certainly get outsized rewards for that. And I think there's, you know, for me at least, something inherently appealing about that.
Yeah, wonderful. There's that book, it's got its, you know, it's got its critics, but it does have some wonderful nuggets of wisdom in it. And
yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, I mean, especially for someone who's inexperienced, you know, I think there's that book, and there are others, I guess, you know, for me, Barefoot Investor comes to mind. Mm-hmm. You know, yep. He also has his critics. I definitely don't agree with everything he says, but I think that, you know, the benefit of those books, and there are certainly others, is that, you know, you need to start the journey somewhere. So things that seem really basic to you and I right now, once upon a time, we didn't know anything about. Mm-hmm. And I think getting, you know, good information, basic information at the outset is important, you know, and ideally you build from there. But, I mean, in my case, you know, with zero background, that was, you know, definitely helpful. And the other thing, as we're talking, that I do remember is my favourite board game by far when we were kids was Monopoly. More or less, no one in my family will play Monopoly with me anymore, and that has been the case for quite some time. But maybe there was something deep down inside of me from when I was much younger that I didn't appreciate at the time. But
I actually did a feedback, a survey of some of our readers the other day, and I gave them the option of Cluedo or Monopoly. Overwhelmingly, it was Monopoly.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, that's great. So you moved into this role at Platinum. Had you been to uni?
No, so I had finished high school, and I was literally studying at night and working at Platinum throughout the day. So, you know, I guess just my financial circumstances at the time were such that, you know, full-time uni wasn't really an option for me. I think I've been always fairly ambitious. The idea of doing a job that wasn't necessarily building towards something, you know, for the time that I was studying wasn't particularly appealing to me. I was, you know, kind of inclined to just get out there and start working and study, which, you know, obviously had its advantages and disadvantages. I definitely wouldn't do it any differently, but I also don't have some of the stories from my university days that, you know, others would have.
Yeah.
But and I think it was helpful, you know, certainly to have some idea, you know, when you're at university and you're learning about how that can be applied in the real world. And I guess we'll talk a bit more about our strategy later on, but, you know, one thing I think is that when you're at university and you haven't yet had the chance to apply things like the efficient market hypothesis and, you know, this idea that everything's kind of correctly priced and this does work and that doesn't work, and when interest rates go up, this is what happens, and, you know, it all sounds so basic and there are these rigid rules, and then, you know, in my experience at least, you get into the real world, mm-hmm. and most of that doesn't apply. And certainly over the past, you know, 10 years or so, you could argue that everything that's supposed to happen, you know, from an economic theory point of view, is if you'd done the exact opposite, you're probably on the right track. Mm-hmm. So I think it was helpful at the time to, you know, understand some of these concepts, you know, in a practical way rather than just something that that I was reading in a textbook.
Yeah, that's great. I think the analogy that stuck with me is that you got to know the rules of the game before you can play it. But I wholeheartedly agree. It's great to have that applied learning. And I imagine just being a fly on the wall, or on the other side of the wall, rather, at Platinum, would have been, you know, eye-opening for you. Were you trading or were you buying shares at this time?
No, absolutely not. No one in their right mind would have let me buy or sell anything at that point in time. So, I mean, my job, you know, literally was, you know, a back office role of the portfolio managers are obviously doing trades, either, you know, presumably through dealers most of the time. You know, this is kind of only when people were using email and using the internet. So we were still getting contract notes by faxes. And I'm not sure if you've ever been unlucky enough to work in an operations-based you know, role at a broker or a fund manager. But, you know, literally little things like, you know, a name and address details that the broker has registered the stock in versus what the actual name of your fund is, you know, going to cause a problem with settlement. Obviously, Platinum being an international fund manager, time zones were an issue, as were language. You know, they bought some Italian stock, and I'm trying to liaise with someone who speaks broken English, and I speak no Italian, and we're doing this at you know, the early hours of the morning or whatever was was interesting. But I think, you know, the thing for me that I probably took away from that the most was just how thorough the process was that they would go through in terms of, you know, deciding to buy a stock or deciding to sell it. Certainly don't have any intention of giving away all of their secrets, but, you know, I think I gained a real appreciation for the fact that there just aren't any shortcuts. I think, you know, you have to do the work and you have to, you know, have confidence in your own ability, but also be, you know, kind of humble enough to realise that you probably can't know everything, and that things, you know, you can have blind spots and understanding maybe where your thesis is wrong. You know, it was an interesting intellectual process, and to watch the team, you know, debate, you know, different ideas. I think that was probably, you know, I mean, I have an amazing amount of respect for what those guys have done since, but I think for someone as young as I was and with so little work experience, to have such high standards and to apply such rigor to, you know, your job and the investment process, I think has just stuck with me ever since. That's, you know, that's kind of my baseline now. Mm. So that's what I expect, whereas that could have been very different had I worked, you know, somewhere else initially, I think.
Yeah, oftentimes we might just pair up with a friend or something and go in and chuck $500 in the share market and see what happens. But I suppose with you,
yeah, look, I mean, absolutely. Having said that, you know, very much so, my first investment I ever made was not a particularly good one, nor did it have a lot of rigor attached to it. But I think, you know, that's really something that kind of stuck with me, is that, you know, there's a lot of people out there you're competing against who are doing a lot of work to try and make money and outperform you. And if you're not kind of going to do that work, no one else is really going to do it for you, you know, typically. I mean, obviously you can have people helping you along the way, but you know, I don't know, people don't hand it to you on a platter, I guess.
So. No, they don't. So after your time at Platinum, you joined E-Trade.
Yeah.
Just the online broker.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. Online broker. Now, it has since had a change of name and is now wholly owned by ANZ. It's not. I think it was actually literally just sold by ANZ in the last 6 months or so. But at the time, ANZ was a major shareholder in the company. That was really the time when, I guess, online broking was in its very formative stages. So my first couple of weeks there, and maybe first couple of months, were literally people who were calling to complain because the website had crashed, or calling to complain because they placed an order that had taken 3 hours to get executed and the price was substantially different, or any number of things, because, you know, the technology platform wasn't robust. It was kind of right at the end of the tech boom. You know, obviously everyone wanted to trade shares at that point in time. The riskier the better. But, you know, that was a really good experience for me because, you know, I didn't have a lot of work experience beyond the time I'd spent at Platinum. But the great thing was no one else had a lot of work experience in online broking in particular, because it was such a new industry that there were no kind of rules, and there wasn't anyone who'd had 20 years experience in online broking, because online broking was, you know, 12 or 18 months old at the time. So I kind of feel like, you know, I've got a lot more development over and above what I would have if I'd worked somewhere more established, just by virtue of the fact that, you know, we were kind of making it up as we went along, and there was no real hierarchy or rules as such. It was like you just had to get through, you know, the days and the weeks, and if you showed initiative, there was a, you know, real opportunity to do well there. So, you know, much like Platinum, in terms of, I feel like I got maybe 5 years experience in, you know, a year and a half, E-Trade was kind of the same for me, I think.
Yeah, and you must have been doing something right. I think I read somewhere that you were the youngest ever dealing manager. Is that right?
Yeah, as far as I know, that's right.
So what does that mean?
So, like I was saying, I think that, you know, they were looking for people to probably step up and take responsibility for things. It was a very young workforce generally, and we had a lot of, you know, customer complaints about a whole bunch of things at various times. And, you know, I guess maybe I had, you know, the experience of working at Platinum, where, you know, you kind of worked hard and you had to be efficient, and, you know, it's not that someone wouldn't help you, but you kind of had to be fairly self-sufficient. So I think probably somewhere along the way I started to show initiative, or that I could take responsibility. I don't know exactly how long it took, but, you know, at a point in time I was more or less heading up the whole customer service and dealing function at E-Trade. Funny story, actually, it was my 21st birthday when I'd been working there for 3 years at that point, and everyone knew it was my birthday, but I think everyone thought it was my 30th birthday, not my 21st birthday. And I did notice a little bit of a shift, at least temporarily, where everyone, you know, especially senior management, was like, this guy's 21 and we're letting him do this. I think everyone had assumed it was too late by then. So I was already, you know, well and truly ingrained in that role. So and that was, you know, interesting from the perspective of a lot of people were moving from full service broking, where, despite being called full service, I think their experience generally was that, you know, it was nothing of the sort. They were probably paying, you know, prior to online broking starting, people were still paying, you know, 1 or 2% commission on trades. You certainly weren't getting, you know, real-time updates about execution or visibility on prices. And I think a lot of people, you know, really moved from full service broking to online. But that had its own challenges, because, you know, just because you can fill in a form and deposit some money into a trading account doesn't really mean that you should probably be let loose, you know, to just buy and sell things as you wish. I mean, there are obviously basic, you know, kind of rules and structures that dictate the market. And I think, you know, and I'm sure we'll talk about it, but that sort of led on to our next role. But we kind of observed that all these people were moving to save money because they felt they weren't getting great value elsewhere. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I guess there's direct costs and indirect costs, and saving, you know, $100 of commission but losing $5,000 because you do something stupid because you don't know better, you know, it's obviously a false economy. So, that was interesting. It was a very interesting insight into investor psychology, and in particular because, you know, the tech crash happened more or less, you know, within a month or two of me starting at E-Trade. So, you know, to experience the investor emotion and how they reacted to that. I was fortunate enough not to have any of my own money in the market at the time, but it was interesting, and I think, you know, also fairly helpful in terms of where my career has ended up so far.
Yeah, there would have been a few horror stories out of the dot-com crash coming through to your desk.
Horrible. I mean, you know, really bad in the sense that, not that I'm, you know, want to put too much of a downer in the conversation, but I mean, there were people who were, you know, had, we had literally spoken to every day for months and months, who were, you know, either having to, you know, sell houses and sell businesses and getting divorced, and, you know, someone who I remember trying to take their own life. Like a lot of these types of things where, you know, I remember one person who had turned, you know, I think $50,000 into $10 million in tech stocks and lost it all within a matter of months, and didn't liquidate anything, sell anything on the way down. And I mean, that's, you know, obviously making $10 million is life changing, but losing it can be as well. So, and you know, I don't know, that's something that definitely sticks with me from that, you know, period of time.
For sure. So the next stage in your career is very interesting. We talked off air about this briefly. You decided to leave E-Trade and start your own business with, I can gather with a few friends.
With Rod and Andrew, who we'd actually all worked together at E-Trade at various times, not completely overlapping roles, but you know, Rod and I in particular had worked fairly closely together, and then Andrew had worked at E-Trade, you know, kind of later as Rod and I were preparing to move off. But yeah, I mean, where that really came from, I think so. E-Trade and ComSec as well had started this process where, you know, if you're an advisor at a bigger firm, so maybe you'd, you know, been at a full service firm, whether it be, you know, Macquarie or JB Weir or, you know, Audemanet, others, you could basically go and use someone else's AFSL or get your own and, you know, start giving advice, general or personal. And, you know, I think the standard model for an advisor at a full-service broker back then was probably roughly 50-50 commission split. So you keep half of what you generate, and half goes to the firm. If you're a fairly self-sufficient advisor, then and you don't need the brand name of the bank or you don't need the research of the bank, then the model that E-Trade and ComSec were promoting was you go out on your own and you pay them, you know, an execution cost for trades, and they'll, you know, execute them, clear them, or settle them, and you keep the rest. So that was, you know, sort of a trend that we were observing, and towards the latter part of, you know, my time at E-Trade, I worked with some of those clients, and you know, like I was saying before, we kind of observed that a lot of clients kind of needed, we thought, something in the middle. So they didn't necessarily need full service, and they certainly didn't need to pay full service rates of commission, but paying discount rates and not having any help or guidance, you know, was problematic as well, and we witnessed that firsthand. So we thought there was a good middle ground where, you know, the model of that business or of our business that we're setting up would be that if you wanted to execute online, then you could, and we wouldn't charge you anything extra for that. If you wanted, you know, general advice, then, you know, you could have that, and we would charge you more. You know, also you could execute by phone, and we would charge you more. So the idea was that the model would sit somewhere in the middle of a full service and, you know, discount broker. That was a pretty good, you know, business for us. And
how old were you at the time?
I was 25 when we started that business. So frankly, you know, probably was maybe perhaps overconfident at that time in terms of our, you know, ability to make that work. But, you know, I think the reality is when you're young and you don't have a lot of commitments financially or lifestyle wise, you know, we felt that we would always get another job without any difficulty if it didn't work. And we felt that, you know, it was worth a shot. And I think our fallback position had been that, you know, during our time at E-Trade, we were already obviously interested in the market, and you can't work in that environment and not be curious about things that are happening and, you know, people who are making money and losing it and why they're making it or losing it and different things. So, you know, we'd already kind of started dabbling around the edges in the market, but, you know, the reality was that none of us had any money. But we're sitting there all day, every day, looking at these things that, you know, and I said to you before off air, it's very hard when you don't have a lot of capital to begin with to just think you're going to buy BHP and the banks or Telstra and, you know, and outperform the market. It's very hard as an individual or a small firm to have better insights into those stocks, you know, than much bigger, better resource firms. But also, you know, there's not that I would have described it as such at the time, but there's beta risk in that in terms of, you know, if you own the big banks and you own Telstra and whatever else, the market dives 5 or 10% or more, you know, those stocks are probably going with it to a certain degree. And I guess we've seen that in the, you know, just the past week in terms of what's happened, you know, with the ASX here. So, you know, we were looking for safe ways to apply what limited capital we had. And I should say up front that I certainly don't endorse this, but to anyone who's listening, we actually started out kind of investing based on money that we're cash advancing from credit cards, which sort of sounds crazy to say out loud after all this time. But, you know, we would often see fairly low risk ways to make, you know, 5 or 10 or 15% return on our money. And, you know, back then the banks were doing a lot of kind of, you know, introductory kind of interest-free periods or 5% for, you know, 12 or 18 months or whatever. So if you can make, you know, 5 or 10 or 15% in a few weeks, then it doesn't seem too crazy to, you know, to pay 5% or so or nothing for an entire year. But of course, that necessitates having something that's fairly safe and not, you know, dependent solely on the market to generate returns, because otherwise it's a fairly easy way to lose money. So I think if, you know, I think about how things have evolved for us over time, we'll get to it, but the fund that we run now is very much a market neutral absolute return fund. The idea, you know, is not to lose money, ideally. And I think there are other reasons why we set the product up in that way. But if I kind of think back all that time ago, I think having started out the way we did, and the other thing is, of course, that when we set up that business, you know, your first clients are typically your family and friends, because they feel like they have to be. Yep. You don't want to lose their money either, right? So you're kind of looking for these strategies or these ideas that are fairly safe, at least as safe as equity market investing can be, but that also is, you know, going to allow you to kind of compound relatively quickly in a safe manner. So that was a good business. We built that up to several thousand clients and we're doing good business, and I think we had maybe 15 or 16 staff at its peak. We got an offer to buy that business, and at that stage, I mean, for me personally, I was the managing director of that business, and I'd go home some days and not know what the market had done, because I was so busy dealing with staff and customers and different things, and I've kind of personally felt that I wanted to get back to something that was more of a market facing role, and the timing of that was good, so that's what we did.
Right, so how old were you when that happened?
So we started HG Securities in 2006, and we sold it in, I think, late 2009 or early 2010. So, and I worked in the business for a little bit longer post the sale. And then really we're at this point where, we had some, a reasonable amount of capital. It was still the time when the GFC, I'm not sure people would say the GFC was over at that point. You certainly weren't getting the market gyrations right at that stage that you had been prior. But the reality for us was we had a, decent sized pool of money. No jobs, non-compete clauses, and no real desire to go back into that style of business anyway. So we'd always been doing our own thing. We'd always invested, in the ideas that we were promoting, to our clients at HG Securities. And, we kind of needed something that really the same thing, not because we're investing using credit cards now, but we have this money that you don't want to be subject to the whims of the market at the time. And, if you kind of go back to kind of 2012 when we're thinking about setting this up, a lot of the things that have resolved themselves in the market since had not been resolved at that time. So I think the other thing that, we were kind of doing that for a period of time, and again, your family and friends want you to invest some of their money, which, you need a vehicle to do that with. So we were already kind of doing it ourselves, and it didn't seem a stretch to let other people get involved. But the other thing that was kind of happening at that time was, and we saw this firsthand in terms of, some ex-clients of ours. A lot of people, when the GFC hit, a lot of older investors were very happy to move their money into a term deposit. A five-year term deposit that you started in, 2007 was about 8% per annum fixed for 5 years. Mm. And you don't need the equity market for that, right? And especially at that time, it made sense for a lot of investors not to do that. The problem was that rolling off those term deposits in kind of 2012, those people are kind of rolling into 3 or 3.5% instead of 8%, and I think we definitely observed a trend of people moving out of safer type investments, such as maybe term deposits, into bank shares and Telstra and some of these things that they were buying for yield, which is all well and good if the capital value of those stocks is maintained. But we've seen it in Telstra since, and we've seen it in the bank since, that not much point having 7 or 8% per annum dividend yield if you're going to sustain a 20 or 30 or 40% capital loss throughout that period of time. So I think we kind of felt like there was a better way to offer investors equity market like returns, but without full equity market risk. So a lower beta, lower correlation style product, which would give people better than what they could get in the bank, but not expose them fully to the risk of the market. So, that's easier said than done. Obviously, that's a good concept, but we needed a way to do that, and I guess we'll get to that at some point.
Yeah, we will. So the business that you started, which has done very well since you did start it, is called Harvest Lane Asset Management. And before we jump into your investment philosophy and we continue with that conversation, There is an interesting point of differentiation here, not only in the strategy, but outside of that is the way you deal with fees. So perhaps you could tell us the fee structure of the business.
Sure. So the fee structure that we use, which I guess is a little bit different to the industry norm, is Harvest Lane is remunerated solely based on performance. So I think your standard structure for most fund managers or hedge fund managers is some kind of base fee, typically known as a management fee, and then some element of performance. And that management fee, in the first instance, goes towards things like paying for offices and salaries and rent and computers and, Bloomberg terminals, all those types of things. But obviously, beyond a certain point, what that management fee really does is, after it's covered all of the outgoings, it's really just lining the pockets of the fund manager. And I think the problem with that is, from my perspective, and I'm not saying that, all fund managers are so inclined, but, if you are just getting this nice little management fee every year and you get it no matter how you perform, then the incentive becomes to just keep growing funds under management more or less indefinitely, because you're just getting more and more money. Mm-hmm. And it becomes less about performance and more about the management fee. And, I think it's a pretty well proven concept that the bigger you get in terms of the more money you have to manage, the harder it is to generate meaningful returns. So typically, beyond a certain point, all managers will struggle. And, we talked a little bit about Warren Buffett off air before, but, he's a perfect example. I mean, arguably one of the world's greatest investors, if not the greatest, but his returns over the last 10 or 15 years are significantly diminished compared to his earlier years. Mm-hmm. And he admits himself that that's because he has so much more money now. So our thought process was that obviously we have this business to make money, both for ourselves on our own capital, but also for external investors. I don't think that most people object to paying fees, and certainly, we intend to do well out of the business. But the nice thing about our model is that people are paying us relative to performance. So if we are earning a lot of money, then they are also earning a lot of money. And if we're not earning a lot of money, then they haven't either, which, is obviously not our preference, but at least they know they haven't paid us to do a poor job. So the model we use is all external outgoings from the fund, which is really just administration, custody, and the audit of the fund, which are all unavoidable parts of running a retail or wholesale fund to some degree. Those costs are taken out of the fund, but that's it. So we pay for all of our own offices, computers, taxis, staff, airfares, etc. That comes out of our performance fees. So we just kind of feel like that's a better model, that it aligns us more with our investors. And I think frankly the industry is moving that way. There aren't a lot of managers that I know of that get remunerated in that way, but investors have kind of voted with their feet. You look at how popular passive investments, ETFs and the like, have become over the past 2 or 3 years. It's because people don't want to pay for something that they can kind of get do themselves or achieve in a passive way. I think that the fund managers who have viable businesses going forward will be those that can bring some kind of point of differentiation or some kind of return stream that isn't easily replicated through a passive vehicle. I would be worried if I was a fund manager who was mostly index hugging and trying to charge any more than the bare minimum of fees to do that, because I think that's easily replicated elsewhere now.
Mm, that's a really good point you make, and I think in a sense it does future-proof your business, at least for a little while. But it's also, I really want to emphasise that paying more fees than you should, it does have a serious impact on your wealth. So especially that management fee, which can be very cushy if you have, say, $100 million and you're earning a 1% management fee, it's quite generous.
Absolutely.
And it's incredibly scalable, not for the client or the investor, but the fund manager. So do you think in a way that this does provide some, I suppose, protection against smart beta funds?
Yeah, look, I think so. I mean, fees are obviously part of the equation. So I personally feel that investors acting rationally, and let's face it, not all investors do all of the time, but how I would like to be judged and how I think, you know, all fund managers should be judged is after fee returns. So, you know, to some extent, the fees is definitely very important, but I think what you get in return for that fee is also important. So, you know, an example of that might be that, you know, if you're with manager A who gets you 15% per annum and charges you, you know, 2% in fees, well, you know, you're net 13 for the year, versus a manager who gets you, you know, 9% but charges you 1% per annum, well, you know, the fee is half but the return is lower. Now, you know, obviously we need to assume that they're sustainable and that will always be the case. And, you know, it's very dangerous in economics and finance to assume that all else is equal, because it rarely is. But I guess my point is that, you know, to me, the rational investor, if the risk profile of both of those funds is the same, should be going for the one with the higher fees that's provided better returns through time. And I'm not sure, you know, how many of your listeners would be familiar with, you know, Renaissance. I mean, they are by far the best performing, you know, hedge fund anywhere over more or less any time period you'd like to pick since they started. I think they're still taking a performance fee of, you know, 45% per annum in addition to their management fee. It's mostly staffed, it's mostly funded now by staff, and people are banging down the door to get the money in there because the returns are so good. Now, anyone who's going to rule someone out purely based on fees is never even going to consider that fund, and that would probably be a mistake. So I definitely think that sometimes the fees are overblown, but, you know, I think it comes down to, if you can get the same outcome in either fund, absolutely choose the lowest one. And, you know, similarly, if you can get the same benefits from two credit cards, choose the lowest cost one. And if you can get the same benefit from two mortgages, I mean, you know, it all makes a difference, right? It doesn't make that much difference now. It makes a difference when compounded over 5 or 10 or 20 or 40 years that, you know, that's where the difference comes in. So, you know, I think especially the way that we invest money, the you know, kind of merger arb and special situation stuff we do, it's very difficult to replicate passively, and there are funds in the US that have tried to do it passively, and, you know, their returns are frankly abysmal, because part of it is avoiding the losses that, you know, if you're doing it passively, you don't have that discretion around what you're investing in and what you're not. And I think in the space that we're in, that's a fairly important differentiator.
Yeah, I think so. You touched on it there briefly, what you do, which is effectively taking advantage of the pricing, I suppose, discrepancies between securities that are trading on the market, or shares that are trading on the market and are subject to a takeover at a price.
Yep.
So perhaps you can explain from a high level what it is that you do, and also the mechanics of how that works.
Sure. So I mentioned before that, you know, we had this great idea that we'd like to provide equity market-like returns without full equity market risk. And, you know, lots of people have tried that over time with varying degrees of success. But one thing, you know, we'd always sort of traded, you know, for ourselves and for our clients at HC Securities was, you know, merger arb, or what people would call merger arb. And I really strongly dislike that term, because anyone with a passing interest in finance thinks of merger arb as being really risky. And, you know, I mean, John Paulson, who was made famous by his bets against, you know, the housing market and the banks at the time of the GFC, I think his merger arb fund lost 50-odd percent the year before last. And if that's the impression that people have of merger arb, then, you know, they kind of run screaming for the hills in the opposite direction when you mention it. But the reality is that, you know, there are very different types of transactions in that space. And the nice thing about a transaction that is likely to succeed, that has minimal conditions attached to it, is that it should decouple from the market. And what I mean by that, so to use an example, company XYZ is trading on the ASX, and it's currently trading at 70 cents. And tomorrow morning, before the market opens, they announce that they've received a takeover approach, which is binding, and the bidder is proposing to pay $1 per share to acquire the company. And typically, you would expect that to complete in around about 3 to 4 months' time. So obviously, you know, there's paperwork that needs to be drawn up, and depending on the between the companies, depending on the structure, shareholders will, you know, need to vote on it or to decide whether they'd like it to go ahead or to tender their shares into the offer. But, you know, to get the ball rolling, they announce it to the ASX. So all else being equal, when that stock resumes trading, I'm expecting it's going to, you know, start trading again at about 96 or 97 cents would be, a fairly normal level. Now, why does it trade at 96 or 97 cents? Well, you know, obviously there's a time value component in terms of you're not actually getting the dollar for another 3 or 4 months. So, you know, you need to discount that slightly. But also, you know, for risk of the transaction proceeding. So, at the moment that's a proposed transaction. It's binding, but typically there'll be conditions, you know, attached to the offer. I mean, like I say, shareholders will need to approve it, but, you know, other transactions may need ACCC approval for competition reasons, or they may need Foreign Investment Review Board approval. Maybe the bidder hasn't secured funding yet. The bidder says they'll only go ahead with the transaction if the market hasn't fallen by 10 or 15% over that period of time. And then the other thing is the price good enough? So, you know, if you look at the existing shareholders in the company, are they going to be happy with a dollar, or are they going to say that's, you know, too low? So all of those factors, you know, will determine where that stock resumes trading. But of course, you know, there's a little bit of margin to be captured there between, buying the stock at 96 or 97 and receiving a dollar in, you know, 3 months' time, which, that return is not amazing, but it's not terrible. And the important thing is that if that offer has fairly low conditions attached, so let's say that you have a credible bidder who has completed transactions before, the bid's fully funded. There's no market out clauses that say if the index falls by a certain amount that it won't go ahead. It doesn't need ACCC approval. It doesn't need FIRB approval. And, you know, a dollar is the highest that the stock has ever traded at. I'm saying that, you know, generally there's a good chance that transaction will go ahead in its current form. But the other more interesting or additionally interesting piece of the puzzle is that no one says that that's going to only be sold at a dollar. So what may happen is that shareholders may not like that price and they may lobby the bidder to pay more than a dollar, maybe $1.10, maybe $1.20. There may be competitors to the bidder who are also interested, you know, in the target, who are also willing to pay $1.10 or $1.20. We've seen situations at times where one that sticks in my mind always is a coal seam gas company, which would have been, I guess, around 2010, perhaps. There was a company called Pure Energy, which the initial bid for that company was a dollar. And within a matter of months, the final bid, I forget the exact number, but it was north of $7. It may have been $8. Ludowisi Group was another, it's like a mining engineering services firm. The initial bid was at, I think, $3.50, which was 100% premium at the time, which is a huge premium. Mm. It ended up, I think, at $11.50 or $12. And one that had happened once we'd already started, the fund that we have now was Warrnambool Cheese and Butter. I think the initial bid was, I think, $4.75 or thereabouts, and that finished at $9 or $9.50. So, that is something that happens infrequently, but often enough that it adds meaningful value to return. So we call that embedded, there's an embedded call option in that price. So going back to my XYZ example, we pay 96 or 97 cents. If we are fairly confident that getting a dollar is our worst case scenario, then, getting $1.10 or $1.20 or $1.50 or $2, we're not really paying for that. The idea of a call option is that it has some kind of premium attached to it, and that, you typically need to outlay money for a call option. In this case, you're sort of getting paid to have that call option. Now, the issue, however, is that if this transaction fails and I've just paid 96 or 97 cents for this stock after they've announced their takeover, then the stock's probably falling back to 70 cents, which is where it was trading before. And in fact, it may actually go somewhat lower in the short term because, there will undoubtedly have been some other parties like us who buy the stock expecting to get at least a dollar and maybe more, who will then want to liquidate their position. So our process really is to try and find, these opportunities where we think that the bid in its current form, so in the case of XYZ, that the dollar bid is very likely to succeed absent a better offer, and that the chances of it going back to 70 cents or lower are very, very slim. However, for risk management purposes, we assume that every deal we do could fall over. We call it break. The deal breaks, and it goes back to its pre-bid trading price, and we will position size accordingly, because inevitably, you know, despite our best efforts and all of the checklists and the process and everything, there'll be, you know, one or two deals a year typically where that happens, where we think that a deal will complete and it hasn't. And the key with this strategy really is the gains kind of take care of themselves. It's the losses that you need to avoid. And if you can avoid those losses, then there's a real edge to be exploited. But the nice thing about these transactions is, you know, if the market falls 20% tomorrow, XYZ should be unmoved, because a dollar is still worth a dollar in 3 months' time. So if there's nothing about that market fall that's going to impact this transaction, then the stock should be barely moved, and if it does move, it should recover quite quickly. Importantly, from a portfolio perspective, if I've got 10 or 15 or 20 stocks that are all subject to their own individual transactions, not only will they not be correlated to the market, but they're also not correlated to each other, because you have very specific circumstances, you know, to each stock, which is driving the, you know, future share price performance. So we didn't end up at merger arb because we wanted to trade merger arb necessarily. We ended up at merger arb because it displays the return characteristics that we're trying to achieve in, you know, the funds that we have, essentially.
Yeah, so that's a really good point to touch on, is that when there's excessive volatility in the market, you know, shares are bouncing around every other way, because these 10 or 15 securities are subject to takeover, you can you know, minimise that volatility and have a very low beta. Can you tell us a bit more about, I suppose, how you go about finding these opportunities, wait for market releases, and then, I suppose, how you value positions?
Yeah, so that is one thing about the strategy, is it's more reactive than proactive, in the sense that you need to wait for something to present itself that you can take advantage of or aim to take advantage of. So, you know, your average fund manager's out there meeting, you know, 100, 200, 300 companies a year, and they're, you know, getting ideas about the company's operations and what the stock might be worth, and maybe it goes in the portfolio now, maybe they want to wait for another time. Our process is much more, you know, ASX announcements and the media generally are a much bigger source of ideas for us than, you know, I guess for a traditional fund manager. So we're definitely buying things post-announcement. So, you know, to get this return profile that we're looking for, we really have to wait for deals to be announced to know that, you know, they're reasonably likely to complete. The problem with buying targets that are speculated or that we think, you know, could get taken over. You know, I could pick a stock that I buy at $2 today because I think it's going to get taken over. If that stock halves in the next 12 months and then gets taken over, well, I was right, but we lost half of the investors' money, you know, in that position in the meantime. So it's very much about waiting for, you know, an opportunity. And that's literally just a whole bunch of, you know, alerts and filters to identify certain keywords that would form part of, you know, an ASX announcement about a transaction. You know, we're kind of filtering down opportunities that then need to be at least skim read in the first instance to see if there's, you know, a genuine angle there. And then, you know, we'll get an idea pretty quickly of whether or not, you know, there's something worth looking at more closely. And, you know, we have a pretty big checklist actually of things that we're looking for that will dictate whether or not this is something that we feel is investable. It may be that we like it, but not at its current price. It may be that, you know, we like it, but there are some things that, you know, remain question marks for us. So that might necessitate taking a smaller position than we might otherwise and wait and see how things unfold. Or maybe we're very comfortable with it and would take a fairly full-size, you know, risk position initially. The valuation part is difficult in the sense that, you know, we kind of have our own ideas about valuation, and to some extent broker research can be helpful in that regard, just to give you sort of the flavor of, you know, what the market's expectations for the stock are. You know, when we were talking about university before, you said you need to learn the rules of the game before you can play it, even if you you know, you don't agree with the rules per se. But I think it's good to have a feel for, what does the market think this stock could be worth? Who are the major investors and what have they paid? We'll have our own ideas. But in some respects, once the takeover process is underway, it's almost like selling a house, right? You have an auction and your house is kind of worth what someone else is going to pay for it on the day. So, you know, if you ask me in our portfolio right now to nominate three stocks that I thought were most likely to attract additional or improved bids, I'd pick three and I'd likely be wrong, because it's hard to know which ones are going to be the ones that attract additional bids. It's more so about making sure that, you know, you have a portfolio of good opportunities that are unlikely to fail, and then the good ones sort of take care of themselves. And to give you a left field example, you know, Certex, we had in the portfolio earlier in the year, and Certex had been a market darling and then had been sold off a lot by the market. They received a bid. I would say we were far from confident about, it definitely wasn't a full-size risk position for us, because we had some concerns about the transaction completing, but more so around where the stock might trade in the event that the takeover wasn't successful. So typically we initially have an eye to the downside in everything, and then you know, everything kind of builds its way up from there. The funny thing about Certex was that almost unanimously the market and brokers and probably fund managers were of the view that it was a good price and that the transaction would go ahead. And literally the day before the shareholder vote was supposed to take place, they received another non-binding bid at a further 20 or 25% premium to the transaction that had already been tabled. Now, if you'd asked me that morning what the chances were that Certex would get another bid at a 20 to 25% premium above the transaction shareholders were about to vote on, I would have told you a million to one. Not impossible, because, you know, nothing is, but it just was not on our radar, and I don't think anyone's radar is something that was possible. And yet it happened. And you know, I mean, I talked about Pure Energy before, where the initial bid's a dollar and it gets taken out at eight, or Warrnambool, which, you know, is bid at 4.50 or 75 and gets taken out at nine. If you ask us at the start of those transactions, you know, what price would you be happy with here? We're never nominating those prices. Or what do you think this is worth? Because you just don't nominate those prices. It's so far removed from what you think is possible. But that's the nice thing about the strategy, is that you don't really have to worry that much about it. I mean, we need to be reasonably comfortable that, you know, what we're paying is okay in terms of, you know, from a valuation perspective. And we certainly need to have confidence in, you know, the pre-bid trading levels, right? So if the stock's trading at 70 cents before the transaction is announced, in the XYZ example, we're probably not using, or we're not using 70 cents as a stop. We would use the 6-month low leading up to the bid, so that might be more like 50 or 55 cents, and sometimes that's, you know, too conservative, but we're really trying to take the view of what is, you know, the worst that's going to happen here. And I think if the stock's at 70 before the bid, and assuming that it, you know, the bid hasn't leaked and the stock hasn't run up excessively in, you know, prior to the bid, I think it's fair to assume that, you know, if the stock was at 70, it should trade at 55 or higher, you know, in the event that the transaction falls over. So that's how we would, you know, kind of build that out. As long as you can get comfortable around your downside risk in each of the positions, you know, the upside a lot of the time, you know, takes care of itself. And that's why we want those bidding wars that, you know, kind of have competitive tension and, you know, where you get an outcome that you don't expect. I mean, Atlas Iron is a recent example of something that we did that I know you're aware of. You know, that situation initially, Atlas was in a position where, you know, the future of the company was in doubt somewhat, I guess. They'd had a bit of a near-death experience when the iron ore price had tumbled previously. It had been restructured by creditors, had performed well for a period of time, and then, you know, they were kind of back in a position where they were struggling to meet the marginal cost of production based on the current iron ore price. They got a bid from Mineral Resources, which was predominantly a scrip bid at that time, and from memory valued, you know, Atlas at around 2.8 cents or 3 cents at the time the transaction was announced. And, you know, the stock traded the discount to the implied value of that bid for a period of time, and then out of nowhere started trading at premium. Now, we had a position at the time, and, you know, we have rules about certain valuation levels where we will be looking to lighten a position. And as a general rule, if a stock is trading 10% above the current value of the best offer on the table, we will be lightening that position. It's sort of an arbitrary number, but the reason that we do that is because most new bids, if they're announced, or improved bids, won't be more than 10% above, you know, where the current offer is. Typically, okay. It would be rare for a bid to be at a dollar and then the next one's at $1.50 or $2. It would typically go $1, $1.10, $1.20, whatever. So, you know, taking money off the table when there's no, you know, guarantee of an improved offer makes sense. And that's what we did in the AGO transaction. So we're starting to take money off the table. I noticed a massive line of stock go through the market at a significant premium to the implied value of the mineral resources offer, which, you know, obviously halted my selling at that point in time. And I can't remember who the first bidder was there, whether it was the first announced buyer of that stock was Fortescue and Hancock Prospecting were the two parties that had taken stakes. And the stock had become very volatile at that time. So basically, you know, through a bit of good fortune, we were able to sell a lot of what we had bought at higher prices during the initial raid. The enthusiasm subsided back closer to the value of the mineral resources offer when no one knew what was going on otherwise. We're able to buy the position back. And then basically where it ended up was that Fortescue and Hancock were both bidding for the company. And the final price looked like it was going to be 4.2 cents. So we'd paid, you know, 2.6 or 7, sold probably at 3.5, bought back at around 3, sold back out at, you know, kind of 4, and we're back in again. We thought that we were getting 4.2 cents and that was it. But through a quirk of, I guess the way the takeover code is applied in Australia, we've actually ended up getting 4.6 cents a share. And, you know, we haven't quite doubled our money, but it's been a good transaction for us. And, you know, that's, I guess, another example of that transaction had very little excitement around it, very little media attention whatsoever. You know, we actually had some concerns that mineral resources may not be successful initially because we thought that shareholders were probably so apathetic to the whole situation given the poor performance of the stock up until then that, you know, the bid may not even proceed. And then, you know, within a matter of a month or two, we're you know, getting 4.6 cents a share. So but the important thing there was that, you know, we needed to keep that optionality over that upside for, you know, to allow that to happen. So whilst we want to be taking money off the table, you don't want to be taking too much off, because, you know, these strange situations happen where things end up trading, you know, much higher than you might anticipate that they would.
You mentioned something earlier on which was about being reactive potentially to news. You have to wait for the deal to be announced and then you take a position. When you're dealing with small companies, say like Atlas at the time,
yep,
does that create imperative on you to start your research immediately and then, you know, get some sort of, you know, just, you do that skim read and then look at the liquidity in the market, see how many shares you can accumulate?
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, the second that's announced, and the ASX have just changed the rules around this very recently, actually. So before, rarely would a stock announce a transaction on any given day and resume trading before 11 o'clock would typically have been when the stock would come out of pre-open and start trading again. So we had this nice little window every morning where, you know, prior to 11 o'clock or 10 to 11 when the stock would go into pre-open, you know, you have time to be kind of doing background research. Now the rules have changed. It's basically just an hour after the announcement is when the stock will come out of pre-open. So if the transaction's announced at, you know, 8:30 in the morning, then it resumes as normal at 10 o'clock. But in any case, you're exactly right. So the good news about the length of time that we've all been in the market for is, you know, in the case of Rod, Andrew and I, it's, you know, coming up on 20 years each just about. You obviously get to know the stocks and, you know, the management, and you have an idea of who the shareholders are, and you have some idea about where the stock's traded and the history it's been through. I mean, all that stuff about, you know, Atlas and the creditors and whatever, I knew that well before that transaction was announced, because you read the financial media every day and you've maybe traded the stock before. You can't help but not know, I think.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, the process definitely for us is, okay, there's a transaction. How binding is it? Is it binding to start with? What are the conditions? And then, you know, who is the bidder? Like I was saying before, are they credible? Do they already have the money? You know, are there any regulatory concerns that we need to think about? You know, who's on the register of the target company already? You know, are they fund managers who are likely to sell? Is there, you know, maybe a strategic competitor or a potential strategic buyer who may, you know, want to make a counter bid? You know, all of those types of things. You know, where's the stock traded previously? What's the average kind of analyst price target? You know, what's the 6-month low? What are their last, you know, earnings, one or two earnings announcements, you know, look like? Any of that type of stuff that's relevant to try and build a picture. And, you know, sometimes we have more than enough time to do, you know, all of the initial work that we would like to do. You know, sometimes we don't. And, you know, if we haven't done everything we need, then, you know, we may not have a position initially. We may have, you know, a half or three quarter size position until we, you know, can check off a couple of other things. You know, sometimes there's benefit in buying early, as in, you know, buying straight away, you might get a better entry. Sometimes you get a worse entry because, you know, people kind of rush in and then, you know, things kind of normalize a little bit afterwards. So that's more an art than a science. But, you know, typically you have a few days to build these positions because, or longer, because what happens is after the transaction is announced, nothing much really happens for a period of time thereafter. If another, you know, competitor firm is going to bid, they won't typically bid the next day. It's, you know, 2 weeks down the track or 2 months down the track or, you know, whatever the case may be. A lot of fund managers, you know, who might want to sell that stock because it's, you know, through their valuation level or whatever the case may be, they're typically not doing it on the first day. That, you know, kind of takes a few days to, you know, kind of make that decision from an investment committee point of view and whatever. So, you know, we don't always have to, you know, buy everything we need initially. There's time. And sometimes there'll be things that, you know, that these deals have a timeline and certain things that, you know, have to happen at certain times for the deal to succeed. You know, sometimes we may have some uncertainty about something. We like the situation, but we want to see how that plays out. So, you know, maybe we add to the position later, or maybe we're confident about something. But then when that, you know, period comes around 4 weeks down the track, maybe, you know, something that we had anticipated happening doesn't, then we might lighten the position. So it's definitely not a set and forget type of strategy. And, you know, I said before, I think this is a very hard strategy to replicate passively because, one, you know, you want to do some filtering or screening to avoid the bad deals. But secondly, you know, things change as the deal progresses. So, you know, just because you want to own it on day one, you mightn't want to own it on day 10 or, you know, day 30. So I think it's, you know, you definitely need to be organized and you need to understand, you know, certain conditions and time frames. And, you know, I guess it's just part of our day-to-day process now. It feels normal.
It's certainly not within my wheelhouse, I'd say, to exploit these types of opportunities. Would you say, I mean, we're not advocating here that you just go out and buy every takeover, into every takeover that's on the market, but is it something that you think's better left to professionals? Or
yeah, look, I think, you know, absolutely a retail investor who is organized and who understands the landscape, you know, both from a market and regulatory point of view, can absolutely do this. But it's a full-time job in the sense that, you know, when we started here today, the market is open, right? Now, you know, I have a whole firm, you know, built around me who, you know, my business partners, Rod and Andrew, and the guys who work in our investment team. I can be here talking to you knowing that if something important happened to one of our positions at, you know, 3 o'clock, it's going to get at least one set of eyeballs and possibly multiple, and that we can react accordingly. So, you know, I sort of feel like a lot of, you know, investment strategies are not part-time investment strategies, as in, you know, either you're doing it all yourself or, you know, if you are doing it yourself, you kind of need that backup, right? Because people need days off and they need time to go and get lunch and they, you know, need to go on holidays and they, all kinds of things, go to the dentist, whatever it is. It's, you know, it's Murphy's Law, right? The hour you step away from the screen or half an hour or the day you take off, you know, this isn't buying BHP or the banks in terms of, you know, you kind of just, I don't think, buy them and just leave it and see what happens, right? It needs to be much more active than that. So I would definitely never say that a retail investor can't do this themselves. I think they absolutely can. But, you know, there are some complications, and it's probably the 5% of things that are easy to miss that you learn through experience that, you know, can maybe sometimes be the difference between losing money and not. And, you know, like I said before, the real key is to avoid the blow up. So if I was telling a retail investor to do this, and to some extent it's our strategy as well, is if something's complex or you don't understand it or you're not sure where it could go wrong, or if it's like an ACCC or, you know, FIRB type situation, you know, something that people often ask me and, you know, that you've referenced previously off air is, you know, this is a complex environment. So how do you know, do we need or do we use experts, right? Do we need to talk to lawyers and, you know, different things? The answer to that question is we will absolutely use specialists, you know, if and when we need them. But in some ways, if a transaction gets to the point where we need specialist external advice, it's probably not a transaction we want to be in, because typically you're getting the expert advice because it's not clear to you what the outcome might be. And as soon as it's not clear what the outcome might be, well, I feel like you're giving up a bit of your edge, because what we want to do is pick things that we don't think can fail, or are very low chances of failing. And then, like I said, we feel like the rest, you know, the gains kind of take care of themselves. If I need to get a specialist on competition law to tell me whether this takeover can proceed or whether the FIRB is likely to approve this deal, well, arguably that's at the point where it's not certain enough that we should be in it. The problem with ACCC and FIRB as well is it's very political. So, you know, a precedent from 2 years ago or even 2 months ago isn't that helpful if you've now got a different government or the same government that's in a weaker position than they were previously from a polling perspective. You know, that's something we're trying to avoid. So I think, you know, if I was telling a retail investor, how do you do this? You've just got to pick the stuff that's safe. And if you don't understand that it's, you know, if you can't tell that it's safe and you're not sure where you can get tripped up, then, you know, I'd encourage people not to try and do it themselves. And, you know, I mean, from a selfish perspective, you know, part of the benefit, I think, of the way that we've structured this type of stuff is that, you know, you're only paying if we do a good job. So, you know, I would hope a lot of people would look at it and go, I could do it myself. It seems like a lot of work. There are, you know, other people out there, Harvest Lane, who could do it for me. And, you know, I think that's, you know, the idea from our perspective. But, you know, I just think in general, like, if you work at UBS or Macquarie or any of these firms, everyone's still people, so I don't think you have to work in one of those places. I think the stock market a little bit is like playing professional golf, right? It doesn't matter, you know, how good your equipment is or whether you grew up in a country club environment or a public golf course or whatever. There's no guarantees. You turn up every week and you play, and if you're good enough, you make the cut, and if you're, you know, even better than that, you win. And it doesn't matter, you know, Tiger Woods doesn't get paid next week if he doesn't make the cut. And the market's kind of like that as well. I think sometimes retail investors can think they're at a distinct disadvantage against professionals, and definitely to some extent that's true, but there are also a lot of ways in which retail investors are at an advantage versus professionals. So, you know, I'm an advocate, and I'm sure you are too, of the fact that, you know, retail investors can definitely perform at least as well as professionals, you know, if not better. So I would never encourage someone not to to do it if that's, you know, what they're interested in.
Yeah, great. Yeah, I agree wholeheartedly. Okay, so let's round out the conversation. There's you've got a great blog that people can access. You can subscribe to the monthly newsletters if they want to learn more.
Yep.
Anywhere else they should go?
Look, we, you know, I mean, that would definitely be the main two sources, I think, of information. You know, we've got some kind of white papers and strategy documents floating around from our early days that, you know, kind of really spell out the whole process in terms of, you know, why we do what we do and some of the risks and some case studies and whatnot. So, you know, I'd certainly welcome anyone, you know, contacting us to talk about that if they'd like to. There are some, you know, decent books out there, mostly US books about not just M&A. There's a book, I think Eli Greenblatt is the author. I'm not sure if you're familiar with any of his stuff. He's got a book that's, I think it's called something like The Little Book That Beats the Market.
Oh, yeah.
Is one of them. The other one is called something really cheesy, like Trade Your Way to Financial Freedom or something, which sounds terrible. And very spooky, but it's actually has good content. And the whole premise of the book, and I guess this just links back to what you're asking me about retail investors doing stuff themselves, the whole premise is all the cool stuff that small investors can do that's very hard for professionals to do in a meaningful size, but that makes a real difference to compounding, you know, wealth at an individual level. I'm not sure if you have show notes or something in your podcast, but maybe you can find those books and put them there. I think they're great. You know, for trading more specifically and mindset, I think, you know, I'm sure other people have covered it before. All the Market Wizards books, I think, you know, are great. Again, just because you see people from such diverse backgrounds in terms of socioeconomic and education and all these things, and they just come up with these cool and crazy ways to make money. You know, some people you've never heard of who just have these great, you know, strategies and make great money, and they've just found something that works. So, you know, I think for anyone who's kind of interested in some of the stuff that we're doing, you know, those books are probably helpful.
Yeah, great. Okay, final question, Luke. If you could go back in time and tell a younger you just one thing about money, about finance, about investing, what would it be?
I knew this was coming, so I tried to make some notes about this, and it wasn't one thing.
That's all right.
I made a list of a few things. I mean, if it was literally just one thing, I think it's, you know, more or less what we just talked about, as in there's no shortcuts and you need to do the work. And you know, your background and where you work and, you know, whatever, I mean, it helps maybe sometimes, but at the end of the day, you know, the market doesn't care about that stuff. Either you've got something that works or doesn't. And I think, you know, you need to have the courage of your convictions and be confident in the work that you've done if you've done it. You also need to be humble enough to realize that you might be wrong, and that, you know, ask heaps of questions. I was a pain. I was such a pain at Platinum and such a pain at E-Trade to people who were my initial bosses, because I just wanted to know how everything worked. And to their credit, they were very patient. But it's how you find out, right? You need to ask questions. You can't be embarrassed. And, you know, you can learn from the mistakes and experience of others. So, you know, I think that's really important. And I think, you know, the other thing that I just wrote here is that, you know, money allows you to do some cool stuff, and it's the things that, you know, we talked about at the start. But I saw a quote probably on social media somewhere not that long ago that said something along the lines of, you know, it costs zero money to be a good person. And I do think, you know, money is just one dimension for me, as in it's great and, you know, it's better to have it than not, I think, generally. But, you know, money doesn't substitute in my mind for other things, such as, you know, being nice to others and having compassion and, you know, all those things that make it easier to be a human being and, you know, have good relationships with family and friends and stuff. So I think, you know, I initially thought it was all about, when I was 15 or 16, probably about the fast cars and the nice houses and stuff. I'm not saying there's anything wrong with that, but I think that it's probably about more than that. So that's not one thing, but, you know,
fine by me.
Four or five things. That's
that's great, and a great way to end the chat. Luke, thanks for your time today, and I wish you all the best with Harvest Loan.
Thanks, Owen. Really appreciate it.
Cheers.
Thanks again for tuning in to the Australian Investors Podcast. For further episodes, head to www.raskfinance.com. To provide feedback, nominate a guest, or hear from me, you can find me on Twitter with the handle @OwenRask. Cheers to our financial futures.